From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On screen, she could use her fists or a sawed-off shotgun, and she'd use them to take revenge against pimps and pushers. Pam Grier was a star of black exploitation films in the 70s. On today's Fresh Air, Grier tells us how skin color still affects what role she gets. Also today, Judith Miller on how we rewrite the history of the Holocaust. Her new book examines how several countries, including Germany, the Soviet Union, and the U.S., have distorted their memories to rationalize the past. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new albums by the Spanik Boys and Ben Vaughan. And film critic Owen Gleiberman reviews Longtime Companion about a circle of gay men dealing with AIDS. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Farmers are criticizing the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, saying the agency has mishandled the flow of water down into Arkansas's Red River. The river is expected to crest later today at 6 feet over flood stage in Fulton, Arkansas. Kathy Lohr reports.
There is extensive damage to the agricultural sector in southwest Arkansas, where fields are underwater and thousands of cattle are stranded. Many farmers along the Red River believe the Corps of Engineers could have prevented some of this flooding by adjusting the levels of dams and lakes upstream. Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton says he's not blaming the Corps for the disaster here, but he is calling for a study of the Corps' actions once the floodwaters recede.
I wouldn't even call it an investigation exactly, but we do need to know whether or not different decisions could or should have been made, and most importantly, whether they should be made differently in the future.
Governor Clinton says much of the wheat crop is a total loss in the Red River area, and he fears farmers may lose the opportunity to plant rice and soybeans. Preliminary estimates of $10 million in flood damage do not include any agricultural losses. For National Public Radio, I'm Kathy Lohr in Little Rock.
Public safety officials in Texas say the water on their portion of the Red River has hit what was probably its highest level since 1938. About 200 National Guard troops are on duty in the area to help shore up the levees. South African President F.W. de Klerk, who met today with France's president and prime minister, says he's hopeful South Africa will soon normalize relations with other countries. From Paris, Lynn Terry reports.
Although French officials say President de Klerk's visit here is private, he was given the traditional military honors for a head of state by French President François Mitterrand. De Klerk met with Mitterrand for more than an hour. At a press conference afterwards, de Klerk said their talks were warm, and he added that he thought the French government now realized that the changes taking place in South Africa are irreversible. De Klerk said he hadn't come to Europe with his hat in his hand, but he did urge Mitterrand to lift economic sanctions against Pretoria.
Sanctions? Is having a negative effect on the capability of South Africa to address the tremendous social problems which we face.
De Klerk said Mitterrand replied that the issue would have to be decided by the European community at its summit in June. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
In South Africa, black leaders have voiced alarm over an apparent increase in attacks against blacks by white extremists. Law and Order Minister Adrian Flock was sent to one mining town to deal with far-right vigilante groups. Black community leaders say the groups have murdered two innocent black pedestrians in the past month. The white minority government fears that the extremist attacks could derail its upcoming power-sharing talks with the African National Congress. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained nearly 6 points to close at 2,636.51. This is NPR News. Defense ministers from the North Atlantic Treaty Organization are considering cuts in their arsenal of battlefield nuclear weapons. The United States and its NATO allies are meeting in Canada in their first appraisal of nuclear weapons strategy since the pro-democracy revolutions in Eastern Europe. The Dutch defense minister proposed a unilateral withdrawal of all nuclear artillery shells, a stand supported by West Germany, where most short-range nuclear weapons are based. The State Department says it's not working at cross purposes with Israel at the United Nations, that the U.S. supports the immigration of Soviet Jews to Israel, but once again, where they settle is the contentious issue. Barry Schweid has more.
After Israeli Foreign Minister Moshe Arens went public, registering his concern about a prospective UN resolution, the State Department said it's the settlements, not the emigration, that's the problem. And spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler reiterated U.S. opposition to Jews living on the West Bank and in Gaza, while soothingly saying friends do sometimes disagree. Behind the scenes, though, there is more to the dispute. The resolution would condemn settling Soviet Jews in East Jerusalem and would assert Arabs who left Israel on its creation 2 generations ago have the right to return. That troubles the Israeli government, but for the time being at least, the issue is on hold. The Security Council has indefinitely postponed considering the resolution. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
Israeli soldiers today shot and killed a Palestinian and wounded 20 other Arabs in clashes in the occupied Gaza Strip. The first man was reportedly killed when troops fired on stone-throwing demonstrators. His funeral procession then drew another 1,500 protesters. Israeli troops in a helicopter and vehicles reportedly fired into the crowd when confrontations broke out. Hospital officials said that most of the wounded were shot in the head. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
She's bad, she's beautiful, and she's back. She's Pam Grier, and when a woman's this hot, you can never get enough.
How about that?
Now, catch this sexy star in 5 of her hottest films. Coffee, Sheba Baby, Foxy Brown, Friday Foster, and Scream, Blackula Scream. She's got something for everyone.
And she's our guest on Fresh Air. Pam Grier was the queen of the black exploitation films of the 70s, doing battle with pushers and pimps. She was a sexy, tough-talking, two-fisted, sharpshooting action hero years before women action heroes were common in mainstream movies. You might also know Pam Grier from her roles as a drugged-out killer prostitute in Fort Apache, the Bronx, and as Philip Michael Thomas's love interest in Miami Vice. Pam Grier is in the new film, Class of 1999. It's written and directed by Mark Lester, who also did Class of 1984. In 1999, the schools have become war zones, ruled by violent gangs. Grier plays a military-designed combat android, which is reprogrammed to educate and discipline students. I asked her if playing a demented authority figure was a change for her.
No, I've played dementia before, actually.
What about authority figures, though?
An authority figure, yes. However, even though we're demented, we are also not human. The figure is a strong figure, and I like to variate between my roles from a very, not passive, but very soft and feminine and a little less strong. And this one is in a robotic, which was interesting because we had to work with and be compatible with our computer technology, which is somehow very mechanic in the film. It is a departure for me in the last, 5 years because I've played less physical roles.
How did you get this role? And I'm wondering if the director knew all of your films.
Yes, he did. Mark Lester was quite familiar with my work and had seen me for some of his other films that he was doing. And he thought I had the physicality to carry some of the 80 pounds of apparatus as a robotic that you wear. And he liked my work, and next thing I know, I had the role.
Do you feel that you're still typecast?
No, but I know I'm usually on that top of the list of someone that could, you know, play a physical woman, such as someone in a police force or a detective. The roles I'm getting, like in Crime Story, I played on television, which was a series for NBC, I was a journalist. I'm developing 2 dramas for series for network are less physical, and there's a comedy that's also being developed, and there's no physical physicality in that. I did a play called Fool for Love, the Sam Shepard play, in Los Angeles for 5 months. Something Wicked This Way Comes, it was different. So I think it's up to me as the actress to kind of choose and select the roles, but I know that they know I'm very strong, very physical, I'm an athlete. You know, I do a lot of things that I can use in film, such as being a certified diver, I ski, I'm in rodeos. So I know they're going to call me as someone who can do something very physical and have an acting ability. So I've honed skills on both sides, the physical and my acting craft.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk with you about some of the blaxploitation films that you were in the beginning of your career. I know when I interviewed the filmmakers Robert Townsend and Keenan Ivory Wayans, they both said that that those black action films were really important to them because it was the first time where there was a black hero and he got to get the girl at the end. He wasn't just the asexual sidekick. Yeah. And I was wondering if you felt you had an equivalent effect for women watching the movies.
Oh, absolutely. Not only was it our images in front of the camera, we had craftsmen and technicians who got in the unions, which are now, which was very difficult to do, and now there are people who are within the business who can, you know, form production companies of their own and who've learned how to do films. So all around, it was very important on the technical side and the artistic side. For me, the films that I did, Coffee, Foxy Brown, and Sheba, were based on the women, the female characters in my family, who weren't very physical, but yet they were very strong women who had to keep a nice house. That's a part of our culture. A woman is complimented on keeping a nice house and taking care of all the kids and possibly having a job also. So these were very strong women, but yet trying to maintain a sense of femininity and just trying not to have a heart attack in the middle of it. And they were all based on, my characters were based on my aunt, my mom, my grandmother, and some of the other women that lived in the neighborhood, that if, you know, they would protect their children with, you know, physical violence if they had to. And I guess for any woman, I think any woman would, whether she's strong or not.
Of course, they didn't go around shooting men in the groin like your
characters
did. No,
but I bet you they would if someone tried to attack them. I know where their knee would go if someone would try to steal their purse or hurt one of their children. I know exactly where their knee would go, or a broom or a brick or a skillet.
What was your reaction to the Coalition Against Blaxploitation that was formed in 1972 by the NAACP and SCLIC and CORE? And these groups felt that the black exploitation films were creating bad role models for young black people.
Well, I think it was fair, but on the other hand, in the films, even though you had our villains, we still had a doctor. We had, my boyfriend was a doctor in one of the films, a detective. We had a wealthy industrialist who was African-American. They always, sometimes they see the heroine. I think what they were speaking of is if the villain became the hero at the end. In my films, that didn't happen, so I'm not sure if I was directly responsible for that type of backlash. But in a sense, what I was saying in my films, I wanted to reflect a lot of things that we were very hypocritical about in our black society. It was that I could see the growing danger of drug addiction and drug pushing and prostitution and the pimps that was growing in our community and becoming quite fashionable. You know, a lot of gangsters, a lot of people see that as being romantic and a way for people who are oppressed to glamorize themselves. They earn a living in a way that's different from most the norm. And young kids would see that, and no one would tell the child, well, no, this is entertaining. And you want to know why the child is there seeing those films. They're a little bit too young. The films that I did, and I'm sure the ones that Jim Brown and Fred Williamson and Richard Roundtree did, those are films for adults. However, the responsibility of the theater owners was a little lax because they allowed younger children with no supervision to come into the films and see them. So therefore, you've got children seeing images that no one tells them, well, no, this is not the image that you grow up to be. This is entertainment. These are the good guys, and these are the bad guys. If the bad guys win, then they'll want to be the bad guys, and that's not a good role model. But as far as the other people trying to do good, trying to help out the community, those were the images that I projected, and I think some of the others did also.
I'll tell you what, let's take a break, and then we'll talk some more. And my guest is actress Pam Grier, and her new movie is The Class of 1999, which is a sequel to The Class of 1984. We'll take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Actress Pam Grier is my guest, and she began her film career playing rough, tough, sexy action heroes in black exploitation films such as Black Mama, White Mama, Coffee, and Foxy Brown. More recently, she appeared in Fort Apache, The Bronx, and Above the Law. She's in the new film, The Class of 1999. I think your first film was Black Mama, White Mama. Describe the part you played in that.
Well, it was a takeoff of a film that was done with Sidney Poitier and Tony Curtis, Terry, called The Defiant Ones, right? And, what was it? Yeah,
yeah, The
Defiant Ones.
Where they're handcuffed together,
right,
they're both prisoners?
So all of a sudden they did a female version of us escaping from a prison, defiantly trying to survive. So I guess, and it had a different title, Chains of Hate. Right, Chains of Hate. And they changed it to Black Mama, White Mama. You know, I'm sure that was to pull in the box office. And it was about two women escape from prison, chained together, and how they help each other. And my co-star, Margaret Markoff, was a ballerina.
Well, I should say the story was co-written by Jonathan Demme.
Yes.
Who is now one of the famous American mm-hmm. filmmakers. One of his recent movies was Married to the Mob. Did you find that a lot of the actors and the writers or directors of these action films went on to establish different kinds of careers afterwards?
Absolutely. Well, you know, we all started with the school of Roger Corman, to how to stretch a buck, you know, and really make it scream. When I was working for Roger, and I was really becoming more and more fascinated by the filmmaking process. I would go in the offices, and there would be Jonathan Demme, Jonathan Kaplan, George Lucas, Francis Coppola, Spielberg. There'd be all these people, you know, doing film, cutting film, collaborating, helping each other out, sharing hamburgers, and, you know, little did we know.
There became, in your movies, I think, scenes you almost had to do in the films. I think it must have gotten to the point where you almost had to have a scene where you had a long, drawn-out series of fistfights with other women.
Yeah, I think that was some subtle, I don't know what you would call it on the air. I'm trying to find a better word for it. I don't know if it was on the part of the filmmaker or that they really like to see women be physical or do physical things or fight each other. I remember there were a lot of movies in the 50s where people really were excited to see women, you know, roll around the floor and fight. And I used to see it in my neighborhood, and I didn't like it. It used to bother me, you know, and it still bothers me. It's amazing because I have this strange contradiction. I have an aversion to violence, and I often look like Mary Poppins the way I dress, and I have that mentality. And then I'll do a film, and it's the antithesis of how I really feel. And it's physical, and it's violent. It's people screaming out in rage, and I think the way I do a film, I see it, and it's something that my mother and my grandparents used to say to me, before you cast stones, walk a mile in someone's shoes. So I think the roles that I play are, I try to play someone who has that rage and violence and try to do it well. And I don't think it's something that I just want to do in my career from film after film or that I had to do. I think I was the only one that was really good at it and made it look convincing. And when I walked away from it, it's just like something that, well, I don't even want to see it. I don't want to have much to do with it. And that's the way I've always been with violence. Even the film in Fort Apache, the Bronx, the scene with the razor blade. After I did that scene, I was very physically ill afterwards. I couldn't do a second take. Thank God I did it right the first time.
Let me go back to some of your films from the 70s. We were talking about how there was a fight with women in several of the films. Mm. There was also castration scenes where you'd shoot somebody or have another way.
Must have been a metaphor. Castration.
Well, it's a metaphor. How did these end up being an almost trademark in your film?
Well, I think it wasn't to be taken seriously. The many of the scenes in the films weren't to be taken seriously. The castration was for people to I think it was like a modern monster movie where you would see something so horrific and people would like, yeah, get them. That's what the bad guy deserves. He was such a bad guy, and people who have different imaginations will see different things from it. And I think the only castration scene possibly was in this movie, Foxy Brown had one. And it was basically tongue-in-cheek and a bunch of metaphors. And I never took it seriously.
Another thing is that in so many of your scenes, your clothes were draped in such a way and you were positioned in such a way as to be the sexiest. So tell me what it was like when they would be positioning you so that you'd be showing off, you know, more cleavage or whatever.
You can't really hide my cleavage. It's just there, unfortunately. I was one of those well-endowed children. And I think, you know, all of that was exploited to sell tickets on behalf of the filmmakers.
Did that bother you, or did you just get into it because you knew that there was a certain camp value in this
also?
No,
it was camp, but it was also an age where nudity in the 70s, we were still riding that wave of, you know, that free love and romping around Woodstock naked and our bodies are beautiful and why should I be ashamed of my body and that. And black women were never appreciated as that woman on the podium. She wasn't in advertising as much. She wasn't considered as beautiful. And black men didn't have these, you know, these black female sexy images to also feel good about their manhood. And I think that was an accumulation of why, you know, I draped and I was sultry and smoky and all those adjectives that they described me as.
Were there a lot of talented but disgruntled actors in your films of the 70s, actors who felt that they wanted parts outside of black exploitation films but were having trouble landing them?
We're trying to get a part anywhere, you know. There weren't a lot of black roles for men or women, period, in films. And the subservient roles, we wanted to play leading people. We didn't always want to play the servants, the butlers, the maids, the submissive, the passive, always the supporting role. So we had a chance to play lead. We had a chance to play a doctor or a policeman or an industrialist in the black films, especially the ones in the 70s, detectives, people in charge of their own lives.
Did you go on a lot of auditions for other films in the 70s? Were there parts that you were interested in?
Many times I'd go on a lot a lot of roles, not only for myself and other actresses. I'm considered tall. I'm 5'8". And many of the actors are 5'8 also. So there was a part that I was supposed to play opposite Ben Vereen, and they really loved my work. However, we would see eye to eye, and if I put on shoes, I was looking down on him. And cinematically, it doesn't look like the ideal, you know, society's ideal image of a couple, the woman looking up and gazing up into the man's eye. So they wrote me a lovely letter and thanking me for my chest, and that I was wonderful and continued success, but I didn't get the part because I was too tall and that their star was diminutive. So that's happened a lot. And also, which is another factor which I brought up, I was speaking up at Harvard and Cambridge about 3 weeks ago. We had a seminar for the black film and law students at Harvard and the film school and law school at Harvard. And it was a four-day seminar, symposium. And we were discussing how African-American actresses and actors are categorized. The darker-skinned actresses, such as Whoopi Goldberg or Alfred Woodard, are considered the more ethnic. And the lighter-skinned ones, such as myself, Lynette McGee, Jennifer Beals, Paula Kelly, people that are a little bit lighter in skin are considered exotic. And we've gone from colored Negro, black, Afro-American, African-American now to exotic. And we were kind of discussing that because there was a part that I was up for to play Winnie Mandela. My South African accent was honed just right. My body movement, I played her very well, could play her on the stage. But when it came to playing her on film, it was a lot different. Because of probably my height, my skin color being light, and my features aren't as ethnic. So therefore, I didn't get the role, but I got to, you know, test a couple of times. And the same way for the role of Suge in The Color Purple, I tested 3 times for that, for Steven Spielberg and Ruben Cannon. However, you know, I had to have a certain look, which many of us don't have because of our ancestry. So therefore, you go in with not only 100%, you better go in with 150%, because after you start whittling away your height, your nose, your mouth, the color of your skin, you know, you're losing, and so you walk out with 50% chances left. And many of us don't get roles just because of those aspects, but that's the aspect of casting.
Well, you know, another thing that I think is interesting is that you've been a superstar among black filmgoers. Like among black filmgoers, especially younger ones who went to see all the action films.
That's so nice of you to say, the superstar.
Well, but yet on the other hand, there's so many people in the white film-going audience, who don't know you.
Yeah.
And it's I think an unusual position to be in, where you know you're a star in one community and not that well known in the other.
Well, that's a microcosm and exemplifies our society because of who we value and who we don't, who we see and who we don't, out of sight, out of mind. On television, I'm quite visible to mainstream because of my role in Miami Vice, Crime Story, The Cosby Show, Frank's Place, Night Court. I do comedy as well. So I get a lot of fans. My visibility on television is really booming. And because of it, I have been offered, comedy pilot and a couple of dramatic pilots, and hopefully we can really hone them and develop them so we can, get a go-ahead. And I've been asked to do a lot of pilots. And again, the factor is I'm either too light-skinned or too tall. But the honor is they respect you for your work, they like your work, they call you in and they call you back and they call you back and they try to figure out, where can you fit in? Will I wear flats on the show? Will I wear my hair frizzy or will I wear my hair straight? Because African-American actresses can go both ways with their hairstyle. And when I wear my hair very frizzy and curly, I look, of course, more ethnic. And when I'm out in the sun in the summer, I come in really, really dark. So it's interesting because I do get called in for different roles at different times of the year. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I just think that these are really interesting observations. I think one of the best performances that you've given that I've seen, anyways, it was in Fort Apache, the Bronx, where you really stole the movie. You were a prostitute who was high on drugs and was a cop killer. You'd go up to cops who were parked in their cop car in deserted neighborhoods of the South Bronx, and you'd shoot them in the face, or in one scene you had a razor in your teeth, right, and you'd stick your head in the car, and you just move your head from side to side and slash someone. And it's a really horrifying character.
Yeah, very horrific. Very.
And Pauline Kael described the performance as giving a feeling of obscene terror, which I think gets it pretty well.
Yes.
Tell me what you did to get into that character.
Well, I really did a lot of research on the streets in New York, and I met firsthand drug addicts. I went to shooting galleries. I met prostitutes on 25th and Lexington and on 9th and 10th Avenue. I went to drug rehab centers. I read a lot of stories, but I just stayed up all night and just walked the streets with friends who helped me, other actors and people, so that we'd be all together and not be, our lives wouldn't be in danger.
Several of your films from the 70s, the blaxploitation films, have been issued on video cassette. Are you glad to have them available again? And do you think that they seem different now than they did at the time?
Oh, absolutely. And people are trying to say, they're campy, they're fun, they're this and that. And all they're doing is just going to a new audience, like 15, almost 17 years later. I really don't have any vision on them. I feel disconnected with them. I see myself in a certain type of role. I'm so distant from it. It's been so many years from it, and I've grown. Sometimes I feel like I'm watching a stranger in strange faces in this abstract form of art.
Well, Pam Grier, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, Terry Gross, thank you. This was really great.
Pam Grier is co-starring in the new film Class of 1999. It's a sequel to Class of 1984. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, John Chancellor, NBC News senior political analyst. He anchored the network's nightly news for 12 years and has reported from 50 different countries. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Judith Miller writes not about the Holocaust, but about how we remember it. Coming up, Miller tells us how Germans, Russians, and Americans have altered their collective memory of the Holocaust to serve their own needs and assuage their own guilt. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new albums from the Spanik Boys and Ben Vaughn, performers making original but little heard music. And film critic Owen Gleiberman reviews Longtime Companion, the first mainstream movie that's come to theaters about AIDS. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Canada, NATO's defense ministers have ended 2 days of talks on the alliance's nuclear plans, with agreement that current levels of nuclear weapons can be cut. They also confirmed that NATO heads of state will hold a summit meeting in July in London. Mark Laity of the BBC has more.
The defense ministers were aiming to avoid splits over the sensitive nuclear issue and to help develop a new strategy for unveiling at the summit meeting of NATO heads of state. As a result, their communique restricted itself to general support for keeping nuclear weapons in Europe, but at lower levels. Later, U.S. Defense Secretary Dick Cheney said it was possible there could be unilateral reductions in NATO's nuclear artillery, and the alliance's General Secretary Manfred Werner raised the possibility of their complete elimination. But there was little discussion of whether NATO's air-launched weapons should be modernized as Britain wants. Ministers said there was no need for a decision now. But there's also no enthusiasm to raise a potentially divisive issue at a time when NATO unity is so important.
Mark Laity of the BBC in Alberta. Washington, D.C. Mayor Marion Barry has been indicted on 6 more drug charges, alleging that he used cocaine several times during a 5.5-year period. Barry was first indicted 3 months ago on 5 misdemeanor counts of cocaine possession and 3 felony counts of lying to a grand jury. He has pleaded not guilty to these charges. The PLO has failed in a second effort to become a member of the World Health Organization. Christopher Powell of the BBC reports that a move by the group's General Assembly averts a damaging confrontation with the United States, which could have split the organization.
The United States, which is by far the biggest single provider of funds to the WHO, is totally opposed to PLO membership. And had the application been successful, the US would have been required by its own legislation to pull out of the organization. This would have wiped out a quarter of the budget, badly affecting the global AIDS, tropical diseases, and child immunization programs. This is the second time PLO membership has disrupted the work of a WHO General Assembly. Last year, the meeting voted to defer the matter for 12 months, but this year, by achieving a consensus, the Assembly seems to have postponed the issue indefinitely. The head of the U.S. delegation, Assistant Secretary of State John Bolton, said the PLO membership question had come full circle, and the WHO should return to life and death issues and fostering better health care.
Christopher Powell of the BBC in Geneva. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 5.5 points to close at 2,638.51 on volume of 158 million shares. Trading was moderate as advancing issues led declines by a margin of 4-3. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Rock critic Ken Tucker says a lot of good music to be heard these days isn't necessarily the stuff from big record companies. He has a review of a couple of new records on independent labels.
The most recent proof that there is justice in the universe is the fact that after 20 years of hard work and good music, Bonnie Raitt has finally seen an album of hers hit number one on the charts. This allows me to overlook such pop cultural abominations as the fact that the hottest selling new album in the country is Depeche Mode's Violator.
Someone to be your friend, someone who cares.
The English band Depeche Mode, whose cold, affectless music sells out American stadiums and inspires teenage riots. Depeche Mode is the robot version of New Kids on the Block. But where's music closer in spirit to Bonnie Raitt's? You know, good, unpredictable combinations of rock and rhythm and blues. It's tucked away on smaller labels by acts you may never have heard of.
I'm gonna get on a ship today, yeah. I'm gonna have to sail away. On a sea of hope, not a sea of tears. I'm going to the promised land. Lights will shine and the moon will be bright.
That's the Spanik Boys from their debut album on Rounder Records. The Spanik Boys are something unusual in rock, a father and son team, Tom and Ian Spanik, from Milwaukee. And before we go any further, let's get a potentially nasty conflict of interest question out of the way. The liner notes to the Spanik Boys album were written by my Fresh Air colleague Ed Ward. But come on, given the quality of a song such as Keep On Walking, it's pretty obvious I'm not playing this just to plug old Ed, right? Tom and Ian Spanik write, sing, and play guitar on all their songs, and while it's possible to pick out some of their influences, I hear Buddy Holly, Hank Williams, and Bruce Springsteen on various cuts, the Spanik's music comes across as hearteningly original nonetheless. Another new independent release, Ben Vaughan's Dressed in Black, comes across as gleefully derivative.
Baby, here you come, all dressed in black. You look like my dark days. You know it's been a long time since I've seen your face. That expression you got, love could never erase.
Hey, 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 hey.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, 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 hey.
Oh, yeah.
Ben Vaughan comes from Camden, New Jersey. He's put out a couple of his own records, but this new one, On Enigma, is probably as close as he'll ever come to a bid for the big time. Vaughan has lots of fans among musicians, and it seems like all of them decided to help him record this album. Among the guest stars are Marshall Crenshaw, Alex Chilton, and the country team of Foster and Lloyd.
Every day starts with a broken heart. I must be too sensitive for this world. Well, I know it ain't right to cry every night. I must be
too sensitive for this world.
And the world is such a callous place. It's a wonder. It's a wonder.
It's a wonder.
Anyone survives.
Ben Vaughan has always had a funny streak in his music, and if anything, he allows Dressed in Black to get a bit too jokey. But at least you'll never mistake him for Depeche Mode.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly.
A one, two, a one, two.
Well, you ask me how I'm doing, well, I'm doing fine. I tell you how I'm doing and I lay it on the line. I'm growing a beard. Yeah, I'm growing a beard. I'm growing a beard, burning my mind. but that's all I wanna do. When it's 9 to 5 routine, it don't agree with me. It makes me oh so mean, and baby drives me up a tree. I'm growing a beard. Yeah, I'm growing a beard. I'm growing a beard, friend and mama, that's all I wanna do. Well, people run around, they're running here and there. For me, I can't be bothered, I'm just trying to grow some hair. I'm growing a beard. Yeah, I'm growing a beard.
This is Fresh Air. This week marks the 45th anniversary of Germany's unconditional surrender to the Allies. In Moscow, the event was marked by parades, while in Bonn, talks are underway among the Allied countries on how to put Germany back together again. After the Berlin Wall came down, one of the first official acts taken by the new East German government was to apologize for its part in the Holocaust. This was the first time East Germany took responsibility for its role. The way different countries remember or distort the Holocaust is the focus of a new book by journalist Judith Miller. It's called One by One by One. In researching the book, Miller visited West Germany, Austria, the Netherlands, France, the Soviet Union, and she toured the United States. I asked her first about West Germany.
The West Germans, I think, have done more to come to grips with the past than just about any other European country that I visited and worked in. And they did that before we start pinning any medals on them, because they absolutely had to do it. No one would let them back into civilized company if they did not. And as a result, they have made extraordinary efforts to let the world know that they have remembered. And they do remember. They've paid almost $40 billion in reparations to survivors and to Israel. And the other thing that really struck me was West Germans have hundreds and hundreds of reunions and commemorations, and I didn't find this in any other European country. And I went back to one of those reunions with 300 Jews from all over the world and watched them confront and reacquaint themselves with people who had helped and people who had not helped, and with the places they had grown up and the people they had known. And it was an incredibly moving experience.
But you think that there's a lot of recent revisionism in West Germany?
Yes, as there is everywhere. Now, when I talk about revisionism, I'm not talking about those people who deny that the Holocaust took place. But the more subtle forms of revisionism are really everywhere and very disturbing. For example, one thing that one can begin to hear a lot of now in Germany is, why is it only the Jewish suffering that counts? What about us? We suffered too. We lost 1 million people on the Eastern Front when the Russians invaded. Why is it that our suffering and the bombing of Dresden and Hamburg, the firebombings, all of this doesn't count? Now, it's not that it doesn't count. It's that their suffering must be put into perspective. They started the war. They were responsible for it. Everything that happened happened to them because they began World War II. And it's the second part of that formulation that one hears less and less in modern Germany.
But don't you think there is some truth in the fact that in most wars, there are victims on both sides, that the people of both countries end up becoming victims?
Innocent people in all countries suffered because of the war. But we must always tell ourselves, how did this war and this suffering begin? You know, we are all guilty here, all of us, even the United States, Americans, by, if not commission, of omission. The question is not, what did they do? But the question should be, what did we fail to do to stop it? And that's where one can really, truly begin to be somewhat depressed and pessimistic about human nature.
In your book about how people remember the Holocaust, one of the countries you look at is the United States, in which there's really been a proliferation of Holocaust remembrance projects. You've tallied up 98 Holocaust-related institutions, 19 museums, 48 resource centers, 34 archival facilities, 12 memorials, etc. What does it say to you that there are so many Holocaust remembrances in the United States?
You know, after Israel, the largest number of survivors came here, and they found shelter, not during the Holocaust largely, but after it here. And they prospered, and they are now aging, and they now feel very, very strongly that they want non-Jewish Americans to remember this experience. And they, the Jewish Americans, have taken the lead in these projects, in almost all of them. And I think that it speaks well of our culture that we are empathetic enough to open our hearts and to build these buildings and to make a statement that, yes, in fact, we do care as a culture, as a nation, as a people, about part of our people's suffering. You know, very few European countries would do that. We, the Americans, really are different in that respect.
But there is some concern in the American Jewish community that Jews are dwelling too much on the Holocaust. What are their concerns?
There is a concern that the Holocaust is becoming, in their words, an obsession. That young Jews only seem to know about the Holocaust. They don't know about the richness of Jewish life in Europe, about the traditions, even about the religion itself. And they find that dangerous, both for the kind of soul and sanity of American Jewry. And I think that is a legitimate concern. And the second thing they fear is that these institutions, these museums that are being built, will become somehow vulgarized, and that the Holocaust through them will become vulgarized. And that's a great danger. I think they're right about that.
Will you describe the plans for something that will be called the Museum of Tolerance? And this is a Holocaust museum that has become fairly controversial. What's controversial about the plans for this museum?
Well, this one is being built in Los Angeles. Its operator, the person who's conceived it, is named Rabbi Marvin Heyer. And many, many Jews have been critical of Rabbi Heyer because they say that he is turning the Holocaust, his museum, into kind of a sound and light show. It's become Disneyland West. The museum will rely heavily on high technology. There will be blackened screen, and you will find yourself standing in front of the gates of Auschwitz with booming recorders in back of you, recreating the what it must have been like. Well, you know, a lot of people just find that very distasteful.
Do you think that there is a form of remembering that cheapens the past?
I think that form of remembrance certainly threatens to cross the line into vulgarity. I think that also scaring people into remembering, which is another technique that the Seaman Wiesenthal Center has used, is not the right approach. You know, he sends out massive mailings to people. His organization, the Seaman Wiesenthal Center, is one of the fastest-growing Jewish organizations, and he basically, his message is, you've got to support my museum, or they, the Gentiles, are going to do it to us again. I think we have to be careful about scaring people into remembering, because you're not going to get the kind of commemoration that we want, which is thoughtful and which is balanced, which is historically accurate. I think you'll just get a lot of scared people giving money to the center.
I think it's fair to say that the type of remembering that you found yourself most moved by were the documented stories of survivors. Stories documented on audio tape or videotape.
Absolutely. There are many of these projects now all over the country, and one that's particularly impressive is being done at Yale University, in which people who are survivors, Jews and non-Jews, by the way, and people who saw something that related to that period came to Yale, and they told their stories, their very personal individual stories. And one story that impressed me enormously was a priest from Poland who had lived near a railroad station in which Jews were being transported to concentration camps. And night after night, he would hear the crying from these cars. And he was then not a priest, just a boy. But one day he got the courage to stick his head through the wooden slots of the fence that had been built to prevent Poles from knowing what was going on. And he saw this horrible scene in which a man who was pleading for a glass of water, a cup of water, with a Gestapo guard was beaten to death just in front of his eyes. He saw it. And he said, and what did I do? What did I do? He said, I ran away. I did nothing. I didn't tell anybody. I didn't say anything. I was horrified and I was terrified and I was unprepared. And I understood from what he had said that that experience had prompted him to become a priest and that he was wrestling with that experience to this day. Now, that kind of personal recounting of history, personal history, although it's not history and shouldn't be confused with it, helps us as individuals understand what people suffered, what it meant, and what happened, and how it changed people and their lives forever.
Have you found yourself wondering how this question of how we remember the Holocaust will be handled a few years from now when most of the survivors and most of the perpetrators have died out?
That's really why I wrote the book, because I wanted to look at the way each different country that I visited, my own country, the Soviet Union, and these four European countries, the way they were distorting or remembering or reshaping or politically manipulating the memory of the past. And even Waldheim, the Waldheim controversy in Austria, it was a great educational experience for the people in Europe. My Lord, this man who was now president of Austria had had this terrible Nazi past that he'd lied about. But when he's gone, there will be no more Waldheims and no more shocks to the collective system of memory in that sense. So we have to rely on other ways of remembering, and that's why these museums are so important. That's why commemorations are so important. That's why history and videotape and anything that can personalize the memory of this event for people for whom it will soon be truly history, that's why that matters, and that's why I wanted to look at it.
Well, Judith Miller, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Terry.
Judith Miller is an editor at the New York Times and the author of One by One by One, Facing the Holocaust. It's published by Simon & Schuster. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, let's see. We have news of the politics of the budget deficit, more drug possession counts against the mayor of the District of Columbia, the NATO defense ministers meeting in Canada. We have a story about Soviet food prices, the Polish Swati, and you know what is probably the most newsworthy thing of all that we have in the program?
What's that?
We speak by telephone with reporter David Binder, who is in Tirana, Albania. This is the first month that you have been able to make a telephone call between the United States and Albania, and we hear about very tentative steps toward reform in what has been the most isolated country in Europe.
Well, thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Longtime Companion is a feature film about a community of gay men dealing with the AIDS crisis. It was produced for the public television series American Playhouse, but this month it's opening in theaters across the country. Guest film critic Owen Globerman has this review.
Longtime Companion isn't simply the most powerful movie yet made about the AIDS crisis. It's also the first mainstream film to take an intimate look at gay life in the 1980s. The characters are a group of hip, upscale New York gays who are friends, associates, and lovers. Craig Lucas's script captures the terrible irony of the AIDS epidemic, the fact that it struck just at the moment when gay men, or at least a portion of them, had found a harmonious place for themselves within the urban mainstream. Longtime Companion starts out as a lively ensemble comedy. The characters lounge around the woodsy summer retreat of Fire Island, where they cruise the beach, drink and do poppers on the disco floor, and turn gossip into an art form. Lucas has a great ear for the knife-edged confessional wit that is one of the enduring legacies of gay culture. His characters have all come through the fervid hedonism of the 70s, and their sexy banter is exhilarating. The movie makes us see how good gay liberation must have felt. Then, before we're quite prepared for it, one character is struck down, and then another, and another still. As Longtime Companion goes on, many more characters end up succumbing to the disease than we at first expect. And so the film, in its very structure, mirrors the ravishing toll AIDS has taken on the gay community. The effect is devastating. It plugs us right into the horror gays have been living through. and it shows us how those who remain untouched are caught in a tug of war between fear and denial.
I feel like something is stalking me. I know you think I'm being melodramatic.
Did you sleep with someone else?
No.
Well, then you can't have AIDS. Because I haven't touched another man since we were in Key West. 1980. Unless you can pick it up on a toilet seat.
I don't know how long it's going to take to germinate.
Well, it's not going to take 4 years.
Incubate?
Incubate. Did you sleep with John?
No, I did not sleep with him.
And then there's nothing to worry about.
My side of the bed was soaking this morning.
Well, so was mine, because it's summer. In the summer, it is hot.
Fine.
And we don't have air conditioning. What?
I'm not a child.
I know.
Stop talking to me like I'm a child.
I know.
Those are two of the best performances in the film by Mark Lammas and Bruce Davison, a long underrated actor best known for starring nearly 20 years ago in Willard. Late in the movie, Davison has a scene in which he helps his lover to die that is one of the most emotional pieces of acting I've seen in years. I wish all of Longtime Companion were that good. The performers, though serviceable, are on the bland side, and the movie lacks the three-dimensionality of a major Hollywood production. Still, you're carried along by the urgency of Lucas's writing, and by the fact that AIDS is treated here with such disarming frankness. Longtime Companion concludes with a sequence some may dismiss as too sentimental, a fantasy reunion between the living and the dead. Yet beneath the scene's obvious wish is a subtler one, a longing for the days when gays were liberated from fear. Longtime Companion is both an unsparing chronicle of the AIDS crisis and an up-to-the-minute portrait of a gay community that has grown rife with terror, compassion, and a palpable yearning to return to a more carefree time. The film says as long as there are people who have to live with that kind of fear, it's everyone's tragedy.
Owen Globerman is a film critic for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Ron Barron, Thad Kirk, and Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, veteran journalist John Chancellor looks back on his long career and looks forward into the future of America. Also, we talk with writer Scott Spencer, the author of Endless Love and the new novel, Secret Anniversaries. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.